Good afternoon. Welcome to the Healthy Aging Show. I'm Dennis Patuas, along with Tracy Taylor. Hey, Tracy, you are really surprising me. We had all these problems with this phone hookup this morning, and, you know, John Perry is just absolutely fantastic as an engineer.
He's amazing.
But your memory is like that of an elephant.
I know.
Remembered how to do a phone hookup.
I did.
The only thing you forgot were the ear warmers, the headsets. Today, we are really pleased to have with us Gerald Winokur. Gerald is a geriatrician. He's Dr. Gerald Winokur. He lives and practices in San Antonio, Texas, and came to our attention through an article that he wrote for the Health Affairs magazine entitled, What Are We Going to Do with Dad? And this got picked up in a number of newspapers around the country, one of which was in our area. And we got the Reader's Digest version, and we went to the website and pulled up the unabridged version, and this is just fantastic.
It's well worth a read. It really is.
Dr. Winokur, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me, Dennis and Tracy.
I'm a fan.
This had to be a tough article to write and a tough experience to go through. You are a trained geriatrician and an internist, and I bet at some point you thought that you had all the answers and figured out that you could provide excellent levels of care for your dad, and then you kind of got swallowed up in the system.
Well, Dennis, you know, I never thought I had all the answers, but I've been a doctor now for 30 years, and for that time, I've been used to solving problems with my patients one-on-one in exam rooms and consultation rooms and at hospital bedsides and nursing homes. I mean, I've as a doctor, I've had to be a problem solver, but I really did see it from another side when my father became ill and his dementia was unmasked.
Now, how did you find out about it? I mean, when were you really aware that there was a big problem?
My dad is now 86 years old, and 4 years ago he developed congestive heart failure. He'd had a heart condition for many years, but he developed congestive heart failure, and prior to that, he was a bit forgetful, and, you know, the family would, especially my mother, would cover for him a little bit, but he was basically functioning independently at home with my mother. But he became acutely ill, developed shortness of breath, one of my associates, who's his physician, because I want to emphasize that even though I'm a very actively involved son, I am not his doctor. But my associate put him in the hospital for congestive heart failure to get some fluid off his lungs. And as you know, and as many of your listeners know, they probably experienced this firsthand. Very often, if you take an elderly patient who is more or less doing okay at home, but they get acutely ill and end up in a hospital situation in a strange and threatening environment, they will develop what has been called as quote sundowning, end of quote, or delusion, become delusional. What this is really is a manifestation that cognitively they have significant impairment. Sometimes it's due to medications, and the situation is short lived. But with my father, it was just moving him from his home and putting him in a new environment, and he within a couple of days was paranoid, delusional, frightened, totally disoriented.
Yeah, there were some pretty compelling passages in the article that you wrote about the time that you spent with him, you know, at his bedside at that point.
Yes, I talk about that in the piece. I've been through this many times with my patients, and I'm always wary when I admit an older patient to the hospital. I try to ask family to stay or to get a sitter or an aide to stay, particularly at night, by the patient's bed. And I did that with my father. I'm fortunate that I'm obviously that my parents are here in town with me, my brother's here, and we really, between us, we didn't want to leave my father alone in the hospital. And I can read a little bit, if you'd like.
Please, yeah, that'd be great.
About that time.
Mm-hmm.
I stayed with my father every night. I slept in the reclining chair by his bed. I got up when he did, ran interference with bed rails, side tables, and IV poles, guarded his every move to the bathroom, looked at every medication that was handed to him, and every fluid-filled bag plugged into his arm. I was not afraid to question the nurse or even call his physician. Each day, my father descended deeper and deeper into paranoid confusion. He couldn't rest. He was intermittently unsure of who I was. At first, I could calm him with my voice, talking about the old days, reminding him of our fishing trips on the Chesapeake Bay when I was young. Then he needed the physical reassurance of my hand on his arm or shoulder at all times. Finally, so that he could get some rest, I got in the bed with him and held him, comforting him as he once, in a long-ago life, did for me.
That's very, very compelling writing. You know, I have to say I'm a big fan of not only what you've written, but how you've written it.
Well, thank you, Tracy.
Now, you had mentioned you're working on a book?
Yes, it's a big undertaking for me. I've done a fair amount of writing as far as essays and poetry and short stories over the years, but I never really felt that I had the time or energy to sustain an entire book. But I've, since this article has come out, I've had so much positive feedback, including inquiries from publishers and literary agents, that I am working on a book that will be about taking care of my father, my relationship to my father, and, of course, about my being a geriatrician all these years.
Well, something else I wanted to ask you about in the article, you mentioned that because of your father's illness, you also discovered something about your mother.
Well, when I took my father home from the hospital, made a decision to take him home because I really felt that to keep him there longer or to transfer him to any extended care facilities, I felt that if I did that, he'd never come home again. He would just remain confused, and I felt my best shot was trying to get him home. And when I got him home, and with his 8 prescriptions that were that I filled for him and got them back to my mom, I realized that he had a hard time kind of figuring out what was what. Her vision was starting to go. She couldn't read the bottle, so I made another trip back to the pharmacy to get the little pill containers, the little containers where you dole out the daily dosing of the medications. And I realized that, you know, from that point on, 4 years ago, my parents were going to need a lot more help than I realized that they were going to need. I mean, you know, you get used to your parents being your parents, and it takes a crisis to realize, you know,
you're the parent,
you know, they've declined. They're not the same as they were.
Mm-hmm. The way you open your the whole piece, you talked about how your father was this, to you as a young boy, this big person, strong and your support, and now all of a sudden you've got a role reversal.
Exactly. And of that, many people have been through that. Many, many, many more will go through that. And it's a bit of a rude awakening, but it is part of the process that we're all going to go through as we age.
Well, that's going to be what we want to talk about on the other side of the break. We've talked, you and I, about the shortage of geriatricians, and that's becoming something of a chant that we've been talking about at every opportunity now, because this is going to be affecting the baby boomers as they age, and over the next 25 years to 30 years, there's going to be a real shortage of care and a real need for people who can address the overall issues of an aging population.
Absolutely.
We're going to cut it short right now, though, and I want to come back on the other side of the break. So stay with us, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to The Healthy Aging Show, and we're talking to Dr. Gerald Winokur in San Antonio, Texas, a geriatrician talking about his experience with caring for his dad. One of the things that we ended up in the first segment talking about is the need for information to get out to people, and actually the lack of geriatricians in today's society and the perceived and the real need for them. And can you speak to some of that? It's your profession, and I'm sure that you see it more closely than any of us.
Yes, this is a big problem that's creeping up on American society. I want to liken it to the situation that we all just watched graphically on our TV screens about what happened in New Orleans. Here was a city that is known for decades that they were in danger of a major flood. Their levee system was not adequate, was weakened. And I want to make an analogy between their weakened levee system and the American healthcare system in dealing with this flood of elders that we will see. Just to give you some idea, the projected increase in people age 65 and older is expected to go up by about 105% between the years 2000 and 2030. That's compared to just an increase in the general population of about 29%.
That's phenomenal.
Oh, wow.
And today, already today, according to the American Geriatric Society, we are already 7,500 geriatricians short of what we need for today. By 2030, we'll be 34,000 geriatricians short. So we need to get busy trying to fill the gaps here in many different ways.
Yeah, there's some clear reasons, though, too, why doctors and other professionals haven't gravitated to the field of geriatrician. And we know that the problem, unfortunately, becomes economics as one of the problems. And there's a rippling effect through on that. But Medicare, which is the primary funding source for reimbursement of services to elderly people, is the prime source of reimbursement for a geriatrician. Is that a correct statement?
Absolutely. And I don't know if most people are aware about how Medicare decides what to pay doctors, but it boils down to this. You know, geriatricians like myself, what we do is we sit with people, we listen to people, we examine people, we go over things again and again, medication lists, we try to educate them. We are performing what Medicare calls cognitive services. These are opposed to technical services, procedural services, a heart catheterization that a cardiologist might do, a colonoscopy that a gastroenterologist might do, removing moles and warts that a dermatologist might do. Those are procedural services, and Medicare, in its wisdom or non-wisdom, reimburses procedural services at a much greater rate than they reimburse cognitive services. And thus, you have most doctors today not entering specialties, internal medicine, family practice, geriatric, where their primary work, daily work, is cognitive services. Yet it is cognitive services that really should be at the base of all medical care in America. Because frankly, as a cognitive service-oriented physician, not only do I think I do a better job for my patients because I actually talk to them and really try to get at the root of their difficulties, but I actually end up saving them from many of my specialty colleagues who want to do procedures on them that they really may not need.
And the time element required for providing services to an elderly person because of the communications necessary between the other specialties, you're kind of the quarterback, and you are the one that's staying in touch with the other professionals, as well as the extended time necessary for follow-up and just to talk out the issues with a patient. It's got to be longer.
It's got to be like moving into the slow lane on the highway.
Well, and it's not only that, but, you know, it's dealing with their families. You know, these days, families are widespread across the country. They can't necessarily come in with their elder parent when it's office visit time. And I spend a lot of time writing letters to people, sons and daughters, making phone calls, answering emails, answering faxes. But I see that as part of my job. But it is totally non-billable and non-reimbursable by Medicare.
And that's the unfairness of it, because you could be off doing something in a specialty like cardiology, and you get reimbursed for almost every minute that you're doing things, and here you are providing services that are definitely adding to the quality of life and care for an individual. I mean, one of the things that we had a discussion on talking to your doctor, that the average time that a doctor gives a patient to respond to a question is 19 seconds before he interrupts. Now, try to do that with an elderly person. Where are you after 19 seconds?
Yeah, well, you know, you really can't do that with anybody. Dennis, I mean, that's one of the problems of our healthcare system today. Primary care doctors, who traditionally have spent a lot of time with their patients, have gotten caught up in this ridiculous system of managed care. If you're not in the Medicare age group, although a lot of Medicare patients are in managed care plans, where suddenly the only way for doctors to survive is to see a huge volume of patients, and we've gone down a road in my estimation that's taken us away from doing our jobs, which is trying to figure out what's wrong, which requires asking questions, listening, examining thoroughly. That is the art of medicine, and that is what's getting lost.
Wow, when I get sick, I'm coming to Texas.
to San Antonio.
Well, it's very sweet of you to say that.
Is there something that we can do that doesn't involve the government, or are we dependent upon Congress to help, you know, to make the change enough that the system can work and not fall apart?
Well, I've read about physicians today that are opening these, quote, boutique practices, end of quote, where they are seeing patients outside of any insurance company, outside of Medicare, outside of Medicaid. They make private contracts with them, and the patients pay them some kind of retainer, and those doctors are available for those patients 24/7.
Right.
I have to tell you, Dennis, I'm really opposed to that method of medical care. I believe that that will just further ensure that we have a tiered system, and people with a lot of money can get boutique care, and everybody else will sort of be stuck in a managed care kind of system. So from a medical ethical standpoint, from a justice standpoint, I'm really not in favor of that. Our practice, we haven't even considered that. So I think it's going to take a grassroots movement by patients, not doctors, because every time doctors speak up, they're accused of being self-serving,
right,
et cetera.
It's going to have to take a
grassroots movement of people saying, listen, you know, we want better, we deserve better. And frankly, Dennis, I have to tell you, I believe that there is so much money being spent on medical care in America today between what the government spends and what private patients spend. There's so much money being spent that there's plenty of money in the system to cover everybody fairly and equitably, even the 45 million people who don't have insurance. The problem is how the money is targeted.
Well, I just read an article that $13.5 billion of Medicare funds were mistakenly distributed and to the wrong people or for wrong procedures. So there's obviously $13.5 billion that we should be looking at. I knew this was going to happen, Dr. Winokur.
We're going to have you back again.
Yeah, that's about the only way we're going to be able to do this.
Okay.
We're running out of time.
Well, I'd be happy to come back.
And you know, this is fascinating. The article is, what are we going to do with Dad? It was published in Health Affairs magazine. It's available on the web. If you go to Health Affairs or if you look up Winokur, W-I-N-A-K-U-R, you can download the article. Or you can contact us at Comfort Keepers.
629-5029. Don't give out other people's phone numbers.
That's somebody else's number. I need your help, doctor.
Well, I can give you the web address for Health Affairs.
Please do.
It's www.healthaffairs, one word, healthaffairs.org. And if you look in their narrative matters section, you can print out the essay for free.
Okay, great. Well, we want to thank you for being on, and I'm sorry to cut you short, but we just ran out of time.
Well, Dennis, Tracy, it was a pleasure, and I'd be happy to come back another time.
Thanks. We'll be back.
Thank you.